Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Brian Clegg about his new book, 10 Patterns That Explain the Universe. How patterns from diagrams of space-time to particle trails revealed by supercolliders offer clues to the fundamental workings of the physical world. Our universe might appear chaotic, but deep down it's simply a myriad of rules working independently to create patterns of action, force, and consequence. In 10 Patterns That Explain the Universe, Brian Clegg explores the phenomena that make up the very fabric of our world by examining 10 essential sequenced systems. From diagrams that show the deep relationships between space and time to the quantum behaviors that rule the way that matter and light interact, Clegg shows how these patterns provide a unique view of the physical world and its fundamental workings. Well, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So as we have gone through the unprecedented times of the global pandemic recently, and perhaps we're still really in the midst of it, I was wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and perhaps some main takeaways that you have gathered from this experience.
Yeah, I think I've been very lucky, to be honest, because there was an initial panic, I guess, in book publishing. I'm a writer, and there were difficulties with distribution. But after a while, it settled down, and the public actually, if anything, were reading more books than usual. So that my actual day job of writing books hasn't been hugely affected. It's mostly done online anyway. It's meant I haven't been able to do talks, which I really enjoy doing. There's a restarting, if I've got the first one towards the end of the month. But it hasn't really too much impacted my working life. Obviously, social life have been a little bit different. It's been quite difficult for everybody, of course. But again, things do seem to be normalizing a little bit now.
Did you have to adjust with the traveling, for example?
Well, not an awful lot, because I work from home anyway, so it really wasn't hugely different. I do a day a week at Bristol University, which was all done online last year, and in fact will be online again this year. So in some ways it was better, because frankly I avoid a three-hour round-trip commute to get to the university, and instead of that I can just come down 5 minutes before and get started.
Oh, there's a bit of silver lining there.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Of course. I am a science writer. I started off with a degree in natural sciences from Cambridge. I originally came from the north of England, from a place called Rochdale up in the northwest. But my degree ended up specializing in experimental physics. And I went from there to do a master's in operational research at Lancaster University. That's really a mathematical discipline that emerged from the Second World War. And it was originally intended to help, for instance, decide what the best pattern is to put depth charges out to hit a submarine or something like that. But post-war, it was picked up by business and also by governments to help them with anything from, you know, how to schedule aircraft, which is what I end up being involved with, through to how to distribute healthcare. So that was a very different aspect. For me, physics was fascinating, but I couldn't see it as being something I'd have a career with, whereas operational research was practical and more to do with people. So that for me was very important to be able to get onto that. And my first job was working at British Airways, the airline, doing operational research.
Were you always passionate about communicating science to people, or did you have to learn it?
I think it was definitely learning it. I've always written. I've always written things, although it was mostly fiction initially. And when I was at British Airways, I started writing for computing magazines, because operational research uses a lot of computing and it's very much integrated with computing. Because of that, it was an outlet, if you like, for my writing. I began to realize that kind of communication of technology was interesting. But in the end, what it came back to was my original fascination with science. I've always enjoyed reading popular science books, the books I've enjoyed for a long time. And I felt it was a good opportunity to make use of my sort of balance of having the scientific background, but also perhaps a slightly wider world experience than some academics. And then when opportunities came from that, actually to do science communication live, I found I did really enjoy talks, standing up in front of an audience and discussing science. So yeah, I think in some ways I wish I'd discovered it earlier. I didn't really come to it until I was about sort of mid-40s. I think these days there are so many more opportunities for science communication. You know, I know people who go around doing science shows in theatres and that kind of thing, and I'd have loved to have done that if it had been around when I was in my 20s.
So what roles did your mentors and your colleagues play along your career journey? And also, do you have any advice for maybe some young career researchers or scientists who actually are thinking about bridging their science career with the science communication career?
Yeah, I think it is really helpful, obviously, to have appropriate mentors. Because I was working in business to start with, they tended to be from that. And when I came out of it, I was very lucky to totally accidentally hook up with a literary agent. It was actually a total accident. I was writing a book about using the internet in business, because I started off by writing business books before I got onto science books. At the time, not many people will probably remember this anymore, but before Google, the leading search engine was one called AltaVista. And so I was trying to research this book. I emailed AltaVista. What I hadn't realized that in the UK, AltaVista.co.uk was actually a literary agency, not the website. Shows you how early this was in terms of search engines, that they hadn't got every AltaVista going. And the agent sort of got in touch with me, discussed about writing, and felt he was really one who pushed me towards the science side and helped me very much with getting started. I think in terms of researchers perhaps wanting to do a bit of science communication, you know, it is hugely valuable these days to communicate science to the wider public, and can be very enjoyable. I think it's really a matter of practice, of getting out there, do it, you know, write a blog, put articles together, and actually send them off to magazines or newspapers or whatever. Mostly you get rejected, but occasionally you might get picked up, you might get some feedback. And you can, if you find it's enjoyable, it's something you can then grow.
Excellent. So your recent book really demonstrates your passion for science. And interestingly, it really brings together seemingly disparate topics, which all have underlying theme, which is patterns. So I was wondering, Can you explain what is the book about and how did you come to writing it?
Yes, of course. So it's called 10 Patterns That Explain the Universe. And it really is reflecting on the way patterns are essential to our understanding of everything around us. I mean, if you think about it, even before we think about science, patterns are incredibly important. You know, if you had to learn how to turn on every single light switch individually, you'd never manage to exist in the world because each time you wanted a new room, you wouldn't know how to do it. But we have the pattern of how a light switch works. And until you go to America and they find they've put them on the wall upside down, you don't have a problem. Similarly, when we start trying to understand the natural world, if everything was totally random, you know, if next time you had a photon, it traveled at 3 miles an hour, 3 kilometers an hour, and the next one was 5 million kilometers an hour or whatever, if there was no pattern to it, if there was no speed of light or whatever, we would never actually be able to do science because we couldn't predict anything about the real world. We couldn't make predictions. Patterns are what enable us to understand the world. And obviously, you know, even before science, they were about survival too. So, you know, humans needed the pattern of what is an aggressor like? Is if there's something dodgy hiding in the shadows? What's the pattern of a tiger or whatever? Something that alerts me to be wary. So patterns are incredibly important. We are pattern finding animals. And if anything, we can even find patterns where they don't exist. So, you know, when somebody is superstitious, that's essentially putting together a pattern that doesn't exist, believing that, I don't know, the number 13 has a particular significance where it doesn't. So patterns are really important, though we can go too far. But for science, they are absolutely essential to understand the world around us.
So why did you decide to put it all together in a book?
Well, I think the thing about patterns is that to some extent it comes from this mathematical operational research background as well as the physics, that that's very much driven by things like probability and statistics. And that's something that always totally fascinated me. And I always look for opportunities to bring probability and randomness and patterns into the things I write about because it's at the heart of what has always interested me most. So it struck me really that, you know, having this enthusiasm for this aspect, that finding a way to bring it to the public would be very interesting. Now, obviously, what you can't do is write about every possible pattern. So in the end, what I've done in the book is picked out 10 individual ones that have particular significance in different ways, trying to make them, you know, as different as possible. So some of them are really quite technical. Some of them are very everyday, but even so, they're very important to our everyday lives.
All right. So let's delve into the juicy science part. So can you define what is actually a pattern?
Well, in a sense, it's an element of regularity. So it might be, one of the sections in the book is on symmetries, and symmetries are obviously very important patterns in the world. So, you know, if something is not changed when you make a reflection of it or when you move it from one place to another, or you rotate it, these are all symmetries. So that's one aspect of pattern, this consistency across either space or time. So, you know, I mentioned something like the speed of light earlier on, that the fact that there is a consistent speed of light is a pattern. It enables us to work out, for instance, how far away different things were. If the speed of light was always varying, we wouldn't have a clue because we would not know from things like redshifts and so forth, we wouldn't be able to deduce the things we are able to do now because the patterns wouldn't be there. So it's very much something that's regular, something that's predictable, but that regularity can occur in all sorts of different ways.
So are the ways to know whether we actually have a pattern, is it mostly computational, like mathematical ways, or are there other ways to know if something is a pattern?
Well, obviously in science, particularly in physics, which I've mostly dealt with, mathematical aspects are very important, and we can't deny that. But if you think of things like symmetries, obviously there are also visual recognition of patterns, the fact that you can actually see a repetition. And it's quite interesting that this also occurs in terms of seeing a pattern that isn't there. I mentioned this idea of the patterns that aren't there, that we're very bad at understanding randomness. You might say if there's such a thing as an opposite of a pattern, it's randomness, something that has no structure, no repetition. And we have this weird idea about randomness, that what it means is that you don't get, say, clusters of events in one place or clusters of events in one time. But if you didn't have those clusters of events, it actually wouldn't be random. You know, if you think about, I don't know, if you've got a jar full of ball bearings and you drop them on the floor, then if they all landed on the floor nicely, evenly spread out, then there would be a pattern there. But that doesn't happen. Real randomness is that some of them are clustered together, some of them are further apart. And so it's very much a matter of recognizing the nature of a pattern, and that could be mathematical or it could be visual. But either way, I think we have a very natural feel for that, inherent really in the way we interact with the world.
So how common are the patterns in a world? Because as you explain, the opposite of the pattern is chaos. And isn't that the second law of thermodynamics, that everything seems to be kind of tending towards the entropy? And
yes, the second law of thermodynamics does say that in a closed system, that entropy will stay the same or increase. But of course, we aren't in a closed system. And that's why we have so many patterns on the Earth. One of the reasons is because we actually have loads of energy coming into the Earth from the sun. And with energy input into a system, then you can generate order. Patterns quite often are generated, if you like, by the input of energy into a system. But equally, having said that, you know, you said about the second law of thermodynamics, if there were no patterns, there would be no laws. There's going to be no such thing as the second law of thermodynamics, because, you know, tomorrow it could be that entropy always decreases. It's a pattern just to say that entropy always increases.
I was wondering about the scales at which patterns can occur. So do they span all kind of from the microscopic to macroscopic scales?
Absolutely, yes. So patterns are, you know, literally anywhere we do science, and of course we do science all the way from the level of atoms and subatomic particles all the way up to the whole universe. Patterns are involved. Again, they're different sorts of patterns. You know, as most people know, at the quantum level, then there are probabilities involved, for instance, in where you might find a particle after a certain amount of time. It's not the same kind of pattern as you'd expect in terms of the dynamics of a ball flying through the air, but there still is a pattern. It still is, if you like, a mathematical pattern. It's just a different form. At absolutely every level, you know, from the pattern of a DNA molecule, the incredibly beautiful and complex pattern that's going on inside of a DNA molecule, through to very simple things you know, the number line we're taught at school. The patterns are there. They're helping us to interact with the world and understand it.
Are there some sort of universal rules for the occurrence of patterns, or can they just emerge?
It's really, again, most of these things, I think, in other words, the answer is all the above, that some patterns emerge spontaneously. So you can think, for instance, of a sort of self-generating system, something like the patterns that occur, say, when water moves backwards and forwards over a beach, and these patterns build up in the sand. They are chaotic in a mathematical sense, but even mathematical chaos is a pattern, because mathematical chaos isn't randomness. It is driven by patterns. It's just that the patterns are so sensitive to the initial conditions, how things start off, that we can't predict the way they're going to develop. But chaos in a mathematical sense is a pattern. It's not randomness. So, they can be self-generated, but equally they can come out of just the nature of physical laws, for instance. So, you know, the pattern of, say, a snowflake comes out of the physical shape of the water molecule, and the angle between the hydrogen atoms in the water molecule is why you end up with those six fold shapes. So it's a mix. It's both. It's set in the physical laws, but it also can emerge spontaneously.
To distinguish a pattern, do we require somebody to be actually looking at the pattern? So like an outside observer. So I usually think about the flocks of birds where they fly around, they form some sort of patterns. But unless I'm watching it, each specific bird is not really aware about the patterns going around it. So am I necessary for this pattern to exist?
I suppose it's an interesting question. The murmuration, which is these collection of birds, it is very much a self-generating system, one that emerges spontaneously from small local interactions. You get the big system building up. And as you say, the birds are only reacting to very local aspects. So from a bird's viewpoint, yes, it doesn't necessarily know that it's part of that bigger pattern and we need to take the step back. But I don't think you could say that, you know, it's not one of these things like, you know, does a tree fall in the woods if you don't hear it kind of thing. Mm. I think the pattern is clearly there in mathematical terms. It exists, but obviously to be able to do something about with it, to make use of it or to interpret it, then you do need the observer typically to do that.
So you mentioned earlier that sometimes we see patterns where they don't really exist. So why do you think that's happening, and why are we so inclined to see these non-existent patterns?
Well, it's partly, as I mentioned, I think a survival thing. So the fact that we are looking for predators, always on the lookout, we are potentially a prey species originally, and there's that. But it's also developed, I think, to some extent in terms of human interactions. So, for instance, our brains are very strongly focused on human faces, for instance, and that means we quite often see, for instance, a face where that pattern doesn't really exist. Famously, I don't remember that there was a feature on Mars that in an initial photograph of it did look like a face. And there was a lot of speculation about, was this created by aliens, this amazing sort of head? When they then got a better picture of it, actually didn't have a face pattern at all. But we're very good at believing that a pattern is in there because we are so strongly wired, if you like, to recognize these particular types of pattern, like human faces. I think it's to do with the way, it's not an area I'm an expert in, but it's to do with the way that the brain puts together images. You know, we don't see the world like a video camera. The brain actually builds up a picture of the world from shapes and edges and color differences. It's a totally artificial picture of the world, and it is pattern driven. And I think it's because of that we are quite good at seeing patterns when they aren't really there. But in the end, it's probably better to see a few that aren't really there than to miss the ones that could put your life at risk.
So in your book, you bring us 10 patterns that explain the universe. So I was wondering, how did you manage to choose these specific ones, and which ones are those?
Yeah, I think whenever you cut down something to a relatively small number, there can be a huge argument about which ones you include and don't include. And, you know, in the end, it's down to personal choice. What I was trying to do is get a bit of a mix. So some as I mentioned before, quite technical, perhaps physics-based ones. Some that might be something we experience in everyday life. Some that are really quite simple and yet have remarkable implications. So I start off with the cosmic microwave background radiation. So what's sometimes described as the sort of afterglow of the Big Bang. And move on to Minkowski diagrams, which are a way of showing space and time that really were necessary to understand and extend Einstein's special theory of relativity. We're still in physics as I move on to the kind of patterns of particle trails that something like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN produces. So in the collisions in these devices, they produce an incredibly complex pattern of trails of particles from which they have to deduce what's happening in those reactions. So that's a very visual kind of pattern anyway. And then we move on to a more sort of almost artificial pattern. It's something called Feynman diagrams, developed by the physicist Richard Feynman to help both explain and do calculations, in fact, in quantum physics. So they're very much a human-generated form of diagram, as is the Minkowski diagram, where things like the background pattern and the trail patterns are, if you like, natural patterns. We've got the periodic table, one of the, surely one of the most famous patterns in existence. I think practically everybody when they're at school probably had a periodic table on the wall in the science lab. Chemists fascinated, obviously, with what's going on there. But then I moved on to weather patterns, so patterns that affect our everyday lives very much. And at the moment, as you know, weather patterns seem to be changing due to climate change. They are of great importance around the world. Then moved on to number lines. And this is a very simple pattern in a way. If you like, it's you can imagine it like an imaginary ruler with naught in the middle, heading off to minus infinity in one direction and plus infinity in the other direction with every number on it. It's the basis of arithmetic, but actually it's got far more going on in there. And it's a human devised pattern that nonetheless seems to very much reflect reality. So I think that's quite an interesting one. That's one of my favorites, to be honest. Then we've got cladograms, which are patterns used in trying to put together the way that different species are related. So it's not so much sort of a family tree as where speciation happened, where different species split off from their predecessors. So they've been very important in our modern understanding of the way that evolution has brought us through different species to the current list of species we have out there. And finishing off, two more. We've got something I mentioned already, the double helix of DNA, probably one of the most familiar visual patterns in existence, which is so remarkable because it is a pattern of information, that it's not just the shape of a molecule, but it actually holds information that's crucial for all biological life on Earth. And finally, symmetries, which can be very simple patterns, but if you speak to any physicist, they're almost obsessed with symmetry because symmetry is absolutely at the heart of the laws of physics. And symmetry and symmetry breaking are crucial to modern physics. So 10 very different types of pattern, but all about our interaction with the world around us.
Oh, that's an excellent eclectic mix of the patterns. So as you mentioned, the way we sort of perceive patterns, one of the ways is visual, and your book sort of really brings it out with beautiful illustrations. And I'm really fascinated by the cosmic microwave background radiation, because I actually just recently learned that this is one of the major hurdles that we have to interplanetary travel. So it's not really the sunlight radiation that is really, really bad for us, but it's cosmic background radiation itself. So which one of a couple of these patterns excite you the most?
It's a difficult one. I always say, by the way, with the cosmic background radiation, there are two things there. There are cosmic rays, which are high energy radiation that is very potentially dangerous. The cosmic microwave background is actually a very, very weak radiation. It's light at the microwave level that is actually very weak. And that itself isn't a danger. It's the cosmic rays that are actually a danger to the travel.
All right, but excellent.
I think to me, if you're looking at all those different ones, I love number lines, partly because I do have this mathematical background to some extent, but also because it's something so basic. It's something that we learn at primary school when we're little children, and yet it is so fundamental to everything we do in, you know, our everyday lives. Arithmetic might seem pretty trivial to a mathematician, but actually it's the thing in mathematics that most of us use all the time. And even at the basic physical level of, you know, what happens if I've got three apples and you give me two apples? It is all number line work, but it's also, you know, when you dive into it, you get into also interesting things like set theory and infinity and all that kind of fun mathematical stuff. So I love the way it goes from something very simple to something quite esoteric. So number lines would be one. I think even though my background is physics, the DNA double helix is probably one of my other favorites, partly because it's just so visually interesting as a thing, but also this idea, because I do have that slight computing background as well, that it is, it's an information store. It's a very particular type of information store, but it works not on binary, as you know we do in computers, but I suppose what you might call quaternary, that this is a sort of a four values rather than two values that they have in binary. And the way that builds together to code for proteins, and also that the way it can be modified to then, if you like, almost act as a sort of instruction set for the construction of a living organism, I think is totally fascinating.
Another puzzling pattern can be the weather pattern. So are we any better on predicting it?
Yes, I mean, that is certainly the good news. I think practically any country in the world, people moan about their weather forecasts because they seem to always go wrong. But actually, they've got hugely better since, say, the 1980s. It was really in the last, 20, 30 years, that the way that forecasts have changed. And this is coming back to this idea of mathematical chaos. The weather is a chaotic system. It's actually where the whole study of chaos came from originally back in the 1960s, was from meteorology. And what happens with the weather is just a very small difference in how things set out as the system develops over time can make a huge difference down the line, which is why it's very difficult to predict how the weather is going to evolve over time. And the change that has made the big difference is moving from trying to predict the weather at one go to recognizing it is this chaotic system. And instead of just running one simulation of the weather, to say run 50 different simulations with very slight differences in the way things start out and combine those together. Mm. And it's because we got those, say, 50 shots at it, that you now see weather forecasts that will say perhaps there's a 10% chance of rain in your area in the next couple of hours. And what that means is 10% of the models predicted rain in those hours. It's actually reflecting the number of the runs of the model with a slightly different versions that produce the outcome. And as a result of that, they have become much more accurate. But chaotic systems get worse and worse as you get further ahead in time. And no matter how good they are, realistically, we don't think they could sensibly have a good weather prediction outside 5, 6, 7 days. So the longer term forecasts are pretty much guesswork. And by the time you get to maybe 4 weeks out, by far the best way of predicting the weather is saying, what are things like at this time of year typically? That's actually better than anything you can do mathematically because it is such a chaotic system.
So weather and climate forecasts are one of those really important patterns, isn't it? And have been throughout human history. So I was wondering if we could reflect a little bit on how important are patterns for our society?
It impacts society in many different ways. Science is one input to that. We can't get away from that. You know, having just partly come through the COVID pandemic, the importance of science and of patterns has been coming through because, you know, all the stuff that we get in the news that we see online, that we get a news broadcast where they have, they're talking about the R rate, the value at which it will spread, or they're talking about the ways that patterns of deaths, patterns of people becoming ill, about the impact of vaccines, all these things are reflecting how mathematical patterns that are involved in the way that a virus spreads are impacting everyday lives. So I think that's brought home very strongly the COVID pandemic, how important it is. But obviously it was there already, whether it was in these medical type patterns, medical diagnosis is all about finding a pattern, or whether it's about how politics works, you know, how an opinion poll manages to forecast how people may or may not vote or whatever. It's all about trying to find patterns, right through to the kind of patterns that, you know, your local supermarket has to deal with in realizing that if the weather's going to be good, they need to have more ice cream available or whatever. Patterns are all there throughout our lives, whether it's in business or science or politics, influencing society.
So patterns, in a sense, are the foundations of our models, are they?
They are. In a sense, a model is creation built around a pattern. So when we make a model, we make assumptions about how what's happening in a system in a mathematical way. Typically, we put that pattern together and run it and see what it predicts and see how that then matches against experiment or against observation. So, you know, science is all about generating patterns in models, comparing them with reality, tweaking the model to have a better fit.
What is really interesting to me when I was going through all of these different patterns is that although they're all different, you can still see something that's connecting them. And in some sense that you can apply lessons or some of the methods from one to the next one, even though some of them are physical, another patterns are biological. So just this sort of transferability of their intrinsic properties is just so fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. You're right. And in part, of course, it's because mathematics has a very wide application. So one of the things that links together many of these patterns is mathematics. But equally, of course, underlying anything, whether it's biology or the weather, whatever you're dealing with, you are still dealing with particles and forces. You are still dealing with, you know, the fundamentals of physics underlying every science in many ways. I'm a bit biased in this respect, I suppose, with a physics background, but the fact is it is there underneath. And so it has that linking role. So, you know, the molecules of DNA, it's down to obviously the physics really of how they fit together, the way that that pattern emerges and the way that weather happens is essentially down to interaction of vast numbers of air molecules and of the, you know, sunlight coming in, so the photons from the sun and so forth. So yes, you have that underlying physics, but also, as we said, mathematics does link things together very nicely in many ways too.
Did you find it easy to explain the patterns to other people? Do you think people have this sort of visceral understanding of what pattern is?
Well, I think that where it did help having a quite heavily illustrated book like this, that most of the books I write are pretty well all text with just the occasional illustration. And normally that's fine. But I think when you are dealing with something that has such a visual impact as patterns, it can be really helpful to have good illustrations that show those patterns and how they how we relate to them and what they're showing us. So I think that helps a lot. And in the end, you know, the job of a science writer is to make what can sometimes be very complicated science accessible. So it's partly in the words, but I think also the images help an awful lot in this particular book.
So what discoveries about yourself maybe or the society along your journey to writing your book 10 Patterns That Explain the Universe surprised you the most?
That's an interesting question. I think in some ways it's digging into a little bit of the historical context that is possibly one of the more surprising and fun parts, because one of the things I think that can help to explain something relatively complex to the general public is to give some historical and personal context. And so it can be sometimes very little things, like, for instance, when the cosmic microwave background radiation was first detected, they actually thought it was a problem with the receiver they were using. It was a kind of crude radio telescope. And there was this background hiss. And what they initially wanted to do was actually try to get rid of it. They thought there's something wrong with the system. And they discovered that there were a pair of pigeons nesting in their telescope. And they deposited what they rather primly referred to in a paper as white dialectic material, material on the telescope. So they cleaned it all out and they just did it again. So then they took the pigeons away a number of miles and they came back. So in the end, unfortunately, they had to shoot the pigeons. And then it carried on anyway. So it's these little details in the way that the pattern's starting to be recognized and developed, I think can be some of the most sort of fun and surprising aspects as you go into and find out more about it.
That is such an interesting concept that you mentioned, that they were surprised there was a pattern and they weren't really believing it. So maybe we have this sort of mechanism of not trusting seeing a pattern because we know that we have the preconceptions of finding patterns anywhere.
I think that's true. I think the other thing is that this was, if you like, before modern electronic communications. And there were people who actually were looking for this pattern at other universities, and they weren't talking to each other. And it was a pure coincidence that the researchers at Bell Labs who actually found the radiation happened to talk to somebody about something else and mentioned in passing this weird thing. And the other person was able to put them in touch with the theoreticians who were saying, you know, we ought to be finding this background radiation, and put two and two together and actually recognize it as a pattern. Mm. So I think it was quite interesting, you know. Also, these days, probably it would have happened a lot quicker because there would be better communication going on and people would be looking out for it in different ways.
And you yourself, have you ever gone down the rabbit hole of trying to find patterns where they, well, shouldn't really exist, for example, in multiple digits of number pi?
No, not really. I mean, I think because of this enthusiasm for probability and randomness and all that, I've never wanted there to be patterns where they don't really belong. I think sometimes there are patterns, sort of patterns, that you enjoy but don't necessarily almost get your head around. So I suppose classic is when they just started thinking about fractals. The Benoit Mandelbrot wrote a paper about basically how far was it around Great Britain? What was the distance around the island of Great Britain? Which seems an obvious thing. Everybody knew how far it was around the island. But then he effectively pointed out that if you start going into all the nooks and crannies, it actually becomes a different distance. And the more of the little nooks and crannies, the more little extras you put in, then the more complexity is emerging in the shape, and it gets further and further. And in fact, the distance around the coastline can vary in terms of thousands of kilometers, similarly on borders between countries, depending upon how straight a line you use, what length of measure you use. And so these people, in looking for a pattern to explain what's happening, can sometimes discover that there is almost this rabbit hole, that the more detail you go into, the more complex the pattern becomes, which is what fractals really are all about, that it's a kind of special kind of pattern. The more you dig into the pattern, the more emerges from it. So I think the rabbit hole is actually quite a good image for that.
No, it's absolutely mind-boggling with the fractals and coastlines. They just keep going and going.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything you would like to add that we perhaps haven't covered in our discussion?
It's an interesting one. I think one of the things, you know, I'd certainly be always interested to know is what other patterns really do interest people, because these were, mm-hmm. you know, my particular set. In fact, I don't know if I ought to do this, but I'd almost turn it around on you and say, you know, do you have another different favorite pattern? Is there something that inspires you in terms of a pattern?
Perhaps pattern that where patterns do not exist. I really want to know how to precisely know that there is no pattern at any time, you know, towards infinity. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a little bit silly, but it just something really fascinates me. How do you actually know that somewhere close to infinity, there's not a pattern?
Yeah, that's such a very good point. Yeah. And I think that's a real opportunity, you know, to think beyond any particular list and look at how patterns influence us. You know, there's a lot of work going on at the moment on how the brain works, how we interact with the universe around us, how we understand things. And that is all as an element of this pattern connection. So I think that there's always lots of fascinating new stuff coming out that is all about patterns and how we interact with them.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us what are you currently working on and what would be your next project?
So I'm just finishing off a short book. I'm a series editor on a series of books that look at new and interesting topics or ones, science topics, or ones that have a particular interest to us in terms of their impact on us. I've just written one, but it's going through the editorial phase at the moment on game theory, because you know, games and how we interact with them is something that interests me. Again, operational research, my background is very strongly linked to game theory, and I always quite like an opportunity to bring that kind of mathematics into a more sort of social and wider aspect. So that's mostly what I'm working on at the moment. Actually, the next thing I have lined up is, funnily enough, is not a book or an article, but it's a story. I do occasionally write science fiction stories, and there's a magazine in America that has commissioned me to write a science fiction story. So that my next actual piece of work will be a short story, science fiction of some sort, probably vaguely computer related, because it's a computer related magazine I'm writing it for.
Ooh, that sounds super interesting.
It's fun. I really like the, you know, the different challenge of writing fiction. And you might think it's totally different, that fiction and nonfiction are totally different, but actually, when I talk to people about how to write popular science, how to write science for the general public, one of the important things is it's still about storytelling. It's still about narrative, knowing how to put a story across, now to knowing how to engage your reader and get them excited in what you're they're reading about and wanting to turn the page and find out what happens next. So there is actually a much stronger relationship, I'd suggest, between fiction and nonfiction than we sometimes realize.
So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
Well, the easiest way is my website, which is Brian Clegg. That's BRIANCLEGG, BrianClegg.net. That has all my books on. As it happens, 10 Patterns is just about to go on it because it doesn't actually come out as I'm speaking to you this minute. But when you hear this, by the time you hear this, it will be on the website. And I also quite regularly on Twitter. It's just at Brian Clegg. So again, BRIANCLEGG.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a truly fascinating discussion.
Thanks very much. It's been lovely to speak to you.